Hello, everybody. Today's lecture is going to be on the Arturo theory. Now, most of you probably have not heard about the Arturo theory, and I would not at all be surprised if the majority of film critics who are writing about film in the United States, or possibly anywhere in the world, will not have heard of it yet. The Arturo theory and controversies around it were absolutely central to American film criticism and, of course, French film criticism, where the movement started back in the 1960s and intensely controversial in the 1970s. Moreover, we don't seem to often acknowledge this, but much of what the auteur theory wanted to do, what its central claims were, have very much become part of the practice of filmmaking today and film criticism today. I will just give one feature of this that should indicate the extent to which the auteur theory's assumptions have become part of our common heritage and our common attitude towards films. If you go back to the 1930s and 40s, a lot of filmmaking in the U.S. was dominated very much by the studio system in Hollywood, with the major studios determining what films were made, which directors got to make them, and which actors were assigned to which roles and all of that. In fact, one could make the claim that directors had little influence compared to the studios in terms of assembling the team that would actually make a film. And moreover, of course, film being a popular medium, it was exactly what got filmed, always was strongly determined by what people wanted to see, what sold. But in between the market and what it demanded, and the director and the actors, of course, stood the studio. Now, today, as you look around, studios don't have that kind of influence. Of course, producers and the people who fund a movie have a tremendous amount of influence in determining what movies get made, simply because without millions and millions of dollars today, movies cannot be made successfully. And these people who are going to fund the movies are, of course, very much aware and keep in mind what exactly the market will sustain and what the market demands. It is, after all, a profit-making enterprise. But after that's done, by and large, direction of a movie is left to the director. The director negotiates with and chooses actors and all of that. In fact, the director is absolutely central to it. And studios don't have the kind of role they once used to have. Now, whether or not the auteur theory is directly responsible for this transformation of the practice of filmmaking is a complicated question. I mean, presumably it had some influence, but lots of other factors also intervened in making this change. However, this change is exactly what one would expect from the auteur theory, what the proponents of the auteur theory advocated from their perspective. The director was absolutely central to making a movie. I will be emphasizing that over and over again as we go over what the various claims of the auteur theory is, what it did contribute, and also what the many, many problems with it were. First of all, let's go back to basics. The word auteur is French for author, but it has some different connotations from what the English word author has. The English word author has the connotation that it is the person who's responsible for some kind of text, some kind of literary text. You have no problems understanding the author of a novel or a play or a poem. And when you think of the author in terms of cinema, you are probably going to think, because of these connotations, of the script writer, the one who produced the film script, who typically is a different person than the director. The French connotation is more about the person who's responsible for the art. And there you include, that's a much more general conception than the English author. So in any way, because of this difference, the auteur theory, the people who write about the auteur theory maintain the French word auteur and do not translate it into the author. Now, the so-called theory starts out with a school of criticism in France, in the early 1950s, originally going back to a director and critic by the name of Alexandre Astruc, but later on, it propounded most systematically in the pages of the journal Cahiers du Cinéma, You will recall that we've talked about André Bazin in this class. He was probably the most important film critic ever in the history of cinema, and he was one of the co-founders of this journal. In the early 1950s, a group of so-called young Turks, younger critics in the journal, began to push it in a direction not exactly what Bazin had been advocating, but somewhat different, and emphasizing the role of the director as the unifying figure in making films. And the first manifesto that was published, the most important one, was due to François Truffaut. This was in 1954, and it was called On a Certain Tendency in French Cinema, and it's obscure, and there are all kinds of problems with it, and we will talk about it in some detail in a few minutes. There was a response to Truffaut and the claims that he and his followers in Cahiers du Cinéma made by Bazin himself in 1957, where he both says good things about the auteur theory, but also rejects many of the central claims that the auteur critics had made, and in particular of what was called the politique des auteurs. The politique des auteurs here refers to either the practice that is being promoted by the auteur critics. That's perhaps the best way to translate politique in this context, though it's very tempting to also translate this into politics, which would refer here to the internal political agenda within filmmaking of this group of critics. And then the theory gets introduced to the Anglophone world by an American critic, a very good one, by the name of Andrew Saris, in 1962, and he coins the word auteur theory. Now, when I'm saying theory here, remember that this is sort of a normative theory, not a scientific theory. It's not just about the description of what happens in filmmaking. It's rather a normative claim of how films should be made. And Saris lays out these assumptions and then generates an incredible controversy in the United States. I might say a few things more about that if we have time. But that's what sparks all the attention to the auteur theory that was actually played in the U.S. We will talk about all three of these papers in this lecture. Okay. So let's go back now and look at the auteur theory. What exactly is the auteur theory supposed to be? Well, as I said earlier, right at the beginning of this lecture, it's supposed to be is that the central dominating figure in the making of the film is the film's director himself or herself. The director's own vision is what creates the film, makes the film into what it is, and this vision should be and can be personalized. If it is, then it reflects something new that the director has achieved compared to less important directors who might have a much more stylized vision, referring to a genre or something of that sort. That's the first claim. And the second claim of the auteur critics then is, we should see, therefore, a certain kind of unity in the director's work. That is, that the same vision will manifest itself, perhaps in somewhat different ways, but it is a vision that will manifest itself in all of the director's films. And the vision here is not just talking about the story and what's told or what the moral is. The vision includes here the technical apparatus, how cinematography is used, how the actors comport themselves in making the film, how sound is used, and all of these things together. And this unified vision marks how great the director is. And so the auteur critics went on to establish a canon of great directors, and then also established or made claims about who were not members of the canon, even if they were highly popular directors. And the canon included a lot of commercially oriented American directors, some of them like Hitchcock or Orson Welles, we now regard to be great, but actually were not regarded by American critics of that period to be quite as phenomenally important as they are now. And this, of course, leads, because of the canon, to the most striking claim that auteur critics are supposed to endorse, and which shows both what the strength of their point of strength in the sense of the how extreme their point of view was, and also what might end up being the most problematic aspect of the view. And that view is that even the worst film by a great director a member of the canon is better than the best film by somebody who's not a member of the canon. In other words, the auteur is so important to the film that it overrides any other consideration that can be adduced in favor of whether a particular film is very successful or whether it is not very successful. Now, before you, of course, the tendency would be immediately to reject something like this completely. But before we do that, suppose instead of saying the best, we could say that in the sense that a work of art produced by a great artist, if it is produced by a great artist, is interesting no matter what. Whereas a work of art that is very, very good, produced by a mediocre artist, even in spite of all its formal and other qualities, may just not be as interesting. So if we replace the word great by the word interesting, which is typically how arguments typically arguments in aesthetics since about the 1970s have worried about what's interesting and what's not interesting, rather than what's beautiful or sublime, rather than what's not beautiful and sublime. So if we do it this way, this extreme auteur critic's claim may sound to be quite plausible. All right, let's go on and look at these three original papers and then turn to what the auteur theory contributes and what might be the problems with it. Now, the another point that we should remember, of course, before we turn to the papers, though, is part of the appeal of the auteur theory comes is that these original French auteur theory, Truffaut, Godard, and people like that, Rivette, and people like that, started out as directors for Cahiers du Cinéma, as critics for Cahiers du Cinéma, and were indeed very, very good critics. In fact, Rivette wrote some of the classic criticism of U.S. cinema of that period, of Hollywood cinema. They went on to become major directors themselves. At some point in the late 50s, they decided that they should put their money where their mouth is. It was not good enough to just write for movies if they were so sure of what made films good and what made films not so good. Then they would show that they were right by making great films themselves. And Truffaut, Godard, and people like that became the mainstays of a French school of filmmaking called the New Wave, which would both produce incredibly complicated and stunning movies, and also set a new tone not only for French cinema but for cinema as a whole. After that, in fact, arguably one could say that, with a few exceptions such as Renoir and others and a few others, French cinema never had any status comparable, say, to American cinema until the French New Wave emerged in the late 50s, early 60s, probably reaching its peak probably around 1962. And perhaps the auteur theory, whatever its faults, must be regarded as extremely important in the history of cinema just because of the role it played within the French New Wave. All right, now look. So what is Truffaut's original manifesto from 1954, which I think with some justice is not that often read anymore except by people interested in the history of filmmaking. It is an extremely obscure document. It has been translated into English, and you can get it from the web. Much of it is spent criticizing in great detail French cinema of the period, and that has become obscure because the films that Truffaut criticizes have not continued to be important enough for people to be familiar with them. And by that itself, the fact that what he's criticizing, even though that those films were regarded by most French critics as being extremely important at the time, the fact that they have not withstood the test of time automatically suggests that Truffaut was onto something. And then, of course, Truffaut goes on and says that part of the problems, he goes on to identify several problems in these movies, one of them being that very often, instead of having a script that is produced for the movie and is therefore integral to the movie, they consist of taking well-known works of fiction and trying to make movies out of them. Yes, taking liberties in the process, but nevertheless, in some sense, maintaining a difference between the two. And one consequence of that, of course, is that a lot of the figures that would be involved in the cooperative enterprise, that is, the making of a movie, would be figures that were somewhat independent of each other, doing their own job. They were they were carrying out the vision of somebody else and all of that. They were not all directed, integrated into a complete whole where they are all expressing one unified vision, and that would be the vision of the director. And then Truffaut goes on to argue that anybody who should be doing this as director itself should be technically brilliant within cinema, should be a master of all aspects of filmmaking. In his words, they must be men of the cinema. And note, of course, given the period, it's not that surprising that he refers entirely to men and not to women. And of course, we should always reflect on the issue of why it is that there have been so few women directors in the history of cinema. Nevertheless, this emphasis on these great individuals who controlled every aspect of filmmaking, the great directors, leads Truffaut already to suggest a canon, and that canon, in the case of the French, would include Renoir, Robert Bresson, Jean Cocteau, Jacques Becker, Abel Gance, Max Ophüls, Jacques Tati, Roger Lienhardt, most of whom are still regarded as major figures in filmmaking today. I mean, people such as Renoir, Bresson, and Cocteau are fairly well-known figures among people who pay attention to film from film and its history as a whole. Also, at the same time, Truffaut presents a very socially conservative vision. We can even think of autocriticism, as expressed by Foucault, as a retrograde step that takes away from the fact that a lot of French cinema was trying to be socially relevant, trying to push an agenda in which bourgeois values were criticized, and that a new attitude to a society was promoted through the art. Truffaut would have none of it. Truffaut wanted, above all, a superb, unified artistic vision of a genius director over there. And of course, Truffaut's piece is none. And Truffaut inspires a fair number of people around him, Godard and others, Rivette. There were quite five or six quite important critics, all writing of the Cahiers du Cinéma, who fall for this autocriticism stuff and use this to redefine what great film is. And as a result, they create an aura around figures such as Hitchcock, Wells, and people like that, and a lot of Fritz Lang, a lot of Hollywood figures who were not regarded at least by sophisticated aesthete critics as being that important because they were too commercial or otherwise, or were at odds with the studio system of the day, are given much more important status by the auteur critics. And by and large, these are the directors we revere today. So once again, it does seem that even at their most early and most extreme period, the auteur critics were onto something very significant about cinema. Of course, even within Cahiers du Cinéma, particularly among people who had been associated with it longer than the Young Turks, there was some question as to whether or not the auteur theory does what it's supposed to do. And these were expressed shortly before his death by André Bazin in a paper on the Politique des Auteurs. In this particular piece, Bazin takes up Truffaut's various claims and tries to show that they cannot all be correct, or at least be fully correct. So first he notes that a work of art can transcend its creator. The auteur theory people are absolutely convinced that a work of art is intimately connected with its auteur. Films express the personality of the director. But Bazin is much more sensitive to the idea that works of art may also express the context in which they are created, the social context. And in particular, that this social context may be far broader than the vision of the auteur, of the auteur. And we will, let me already raise an example that we've encountered earlier in previous lectures. This is the sort of issue that comes up when we look at a movie, a film like Do the Right Thing. Clearly, there is Spike Lee's vision. He's both a major actor of the film and also the director of the film and wrote the script. Yet, even though Spike Lee intended the character Sal to be a racist, we, when we look at the movie, have good reason to worry about whether that assessment of Sal is correct. And in particular, we note that the author who played Sal was convinced that Sal was not a racist. And so, in other words, the complexity surrounding the character of Sal transcends what Spike Lee intended to achieve. Now, it may be that there was things that Spike Lee intended to achieve, but things that come out of sensibility because of context that become important. But it doesn't matter how context intervenes, whether or not it does so at an implicit or subconscious or unconscious, whatever you want to say, level with the director, or whether it does so by others. For example, an actor bringing a particular attitude towards a character, as in the case of Sal, whatever it is, this goes against the claims of the auteur critics. And Bazin was right to emphasize that over and over again. Bazin also thought that one consequence of that is people did not realize that there might be a great difference in quality in the work of certain directors. For example, the example that he's worried about is John Huston, who both produced some movies that were not films that were mediocre in the extreme, but also some absolute classics. For example, well, this is long after Bazin's period, of course, in the case of Huston, who is not recognized as part of the canon by the auteur of critics. Eventually, he produced the movie Chinatown in 1974, which is widely regarded as one of the best movies from that generation. And then Bazin also goes on to say that this cult of the director, right, as he eventually calls it, an aesthetic personality cult, this cult of the director also leads to completely ludicrous judgments of some very mediocre works produced by great directors. One only has to think of Charlie Chaplin in Limelight towards the end of his life. And one realizes that not every movie that a particular director produces is quite that great. Limelight is a good example in the case of Chaplin, but A King in New York is another example of Chaplin's late films, which do not rise to the level of his great works from the 1930s. Okay. And so this is, and in fact, ultimately Bazin is condemned of the auteur theory as a personality cult. Now, Sarris, shortly after Bazin's death in 1962, in writing in English, this is the first time that the auteur theory has been seriously dealt with in the English language, attempts to answer Bazin, and that's the paper you're supposed to have wrote, Notes on the Auteur Theory in 1962, which must be one of the most uninspired titles for a piece that is supposed to be a manifesto in art criticism, in this case, film criticism. And you note Sarris does not explicitly, even though he's giving an account of the theory, in English, does not try to translate what auteur is supposed to mean, because it's clearly a different notion of authorship than what is implied by the French term. And in particular, Sarris, who in general agrees with many of the things that Bazin says, takes issue with two things. And our question is it correct about either of them? One of them is it possible to honor a work of art without honoring the artist involved? And he answers, I think not. And this is something that we should worry about. Is, for example, go back to an example that Kanofsky uses often about a great, great work of art, which is the Gothic Cathedral. To a large extent, for any Gothic cathedral, we do not know who the artists are. And it would be ludicrous to suggest that a single artist is responsible for them. Now, can we honor a work of art without honoring the artist? Well, in some sense, we always do when we talk about how great works of architecture Gothic cathedrals are. But if you don't like the Gothic cathedral, take things like the Taj Mahal. We do not know who the artists are by and large. We know some of them, but not a whole lot about them. Now, you might say that implicitly we are honoring the artist, even though we don't know who the artist is, and we are looking at the vision of the artist. But how often, when you're looking at a Gothic cathedral, do you wonder about the vision of the person who created it, rather admiring it for, at one end, for how space is being used, how magnificently light is used when you're standing inside and have the light mediated by all those stained glass windows that give this wonderful spacious feeling inside it. And then you worry about the values of the society that leads to all the sculptures, the gargoyles, and all of that, and the roles they play in medieval life. At what stage are you actually worried about the vision of the artist and trying to honor the artist? And the second thing that Bazin says is that, that Sarris says against Bazin is that Bazin is presumably has been giving too much attention to social determinism in creating a work of art, and he thinks that the relationship is a lot more complicated and that there's reciprocity over it. And now there's a very, very interesting question, the extent to which an artist stands outside society, or to the extent the artist is a product of the society, and this is an old theme of the artist's genius, and we will turn to that in a second. And after that, what is really important about Bazin's piece is that he goes on and develops what it takes to be the three premises of the artist theory. The first one, of course, is that the auteur theory is that the auteur must have full technical competence, otherwise he would not be very good as an auteur. And this is beyond controversy and goes back to premise to Truffaut. The second premise, of course, is that the distinguishable personality of the director must be seen in every film, and therefore in all of the director's films. Once again, it goes back to Truffaut. But then he has a third premise, that what is being expressed is the interior meaning. Okay, and here he goes all mystical. What is it that makes a great director great? And here it's almost like we almost have this issue of the what we're getting into is that Sarris ties himself into Kantian knots. At the end of the day, it's almost like Kant saying that a work of art is a great work of art only because it's created by a genius. There are no rules as to what it is, and that's the kind of mysticism that seems to be embodied here in Sarris's advocacy of the auteur theory. Now, what we are not going to discuss today is all the controversy that Sarris's piece generated immediately when it came out. There was a scathing rebuttal by Pauline Kael, a very well-known film critic who usually wrote for the New York Times and is regarded as a major critic from the period. Sarris responds back to Kael. And then, of course, Sarris does what is most important. He uses this theory to reconstruct a history of American cinema. This is published in 1968. It's called The American Cinema, Directors and Directions. In this book, the entire history of American cinema is reconstructed from the auteur theory point of view. That is, this history is seen as a sequence of great directors giving new directions to American cinema. And at the end of the day, how good the auteur theory, or how valuable the auteur theory is going to be dependent to a very large extent on how good we think this history of American cinema is. Do we think it's a bad way of understanding that history, or do you think it is extremely perceptive in how it does so? And the jury, after a generation, the jury is still out. At one end, clearly, we nowadays tend to think about great directors and what they did, and that's how almost every reading for your contemporary reading in your course has emphasized directors over and over again. At the other end, historically, it doesn't that quite miss the boat because of the extent to which the dynamics of American cinema in the 1930s and 1940s were driven not by the directors but by the studio. Anyway, we will turn to an evaluation of the auteur theory, but let us briefly at least look at two issues before we get there. One of them is how socially conservative was the theory, and here Truffaut's original 1954 piece clearly was extremely conservative, almost reactionary in the claims that it defended and made. But at the same time, we should remember that Truffaut is just one of the auteur critics. Others, such as Godard, had much more of a social conscience and all of that, and there was much more diversity in points of view between various members of Cahiers du Cinéma who endorsed the auteur theory than we usually accept. But it is also true that by keeping on emphasizing the individual director at the expense of social forces, the auteur theory is urging something that goes very much against any socially relevant understanding or socially determined understanding of cinema. It almost almost immediately goes back to old-fashioned ideas of art for art's sake, you know, that where the individual expression is what creates the art, the idea of the artist being a genius, very often the artist being the troubled genius, rejected by society, all these old themes about what constitutes great art that was challenged tremendously in the 20th century. You can also say that what the auteur theory is trying to do is to recover for directors the sense of aura that Benjamin rejected in the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, the disappearance of an aura and bringing good art in cinema to mass audiences where art is no longer something enjoyed only by the privileged. All of that seems to go out of the window when you reinstitute the idea of aura of the director and all of that. And the other issue that we should deal with is, do we continue to pay attention to the auteur theory only because the auteur critics soon became really important members of the French New Wave? Perhaps. But by the time the French New Wave was there, these directors had gone beyond the auteur theory. And the French New Wave is more general than the auteur theory. And it generates the part of the auteur theory that survives there is the idea of the personal vision being followed by directors in their films and all of them. And here, though, this idea that this results in great film goes back to people like Hitchcock and people like Orson Welles, American directors, long before the French New Wave. And so in some sense, the success of the auteur theory and the validity of its premises, its normative premises, has to be judged in a much broader context than just the French New Wave. Another way of putting that is that just because the French Wave was great does not make the auteur theory more plausible. And also, we might be able to say that the auteur theory did do something valuable, or did provide some valuable insights for our understanding of film, even without the achievement, the cinematic achievements of the French New Wave. Well, look, let's turn to the question of how plausible, three questions. First, how plausible is the auteur theory, right? Second, we will ask, what role did it play in the history of film? And third, what has it contributed to film criticism, film theory, and the philosophy of film? Now, how plausible is it? We will spend some time about that. As far as its role in history, I don't think I want to say anything more about that right now, because I've been talking about that for the last half hour, and that's mainly what we've been discussing. And finally, we'll come back to the issue of what is its role in film criticism, philosophy of film, and film theory. So how plausible it is? Well, look at some contracts. Panofsky. We read a lot of Panofsky early on in this course, and what Panofsky emphasizes over and over again is the vast integrative cooperative participation of a wide variety of agents in the creation of a film. And he goes and he explicitly compares the creation of the film to the construction of a Gothic cathedral. And so all these different contributions with all their individualities somehow has to be meshed together to create a great film. And he does not give any special status to a director, though in some sense, you can say that even if he doesn't, implicitly must have felt that, because then when you go and you look at his writings on film and the individuals he refers to, the vast majority of them are directors and not actors or anybody else. But nevertheless, this idea of the cooperative vision is a good contrast to what the auteur theory claims. The second issue, of course, is beyond the director. Do films end up expressing part of the social context in which the film is made? We've already dealt with that by talking about Do the Right Thing and the question of whether or not Sal happens to be a racist. That is an important thing to keep in mind. So we have two things now so far. We have talked about the cooperative issue, the issue of social context. Nevertheless, the issue, one thing that will stand out at the third point in favor of the auteur theory is we do tend to think of films in terms of their directors a lot of the time. Not all of the time, a lot of the time. And I've been emphasizing that over and over again as I've been talking about the canon, using the names of directors that we all admire and stuff like that. But, and this is the fourth point over here, is we also very often talk about films as being what they are because of their actor. In some cases, the actor is also the director. When you think of Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin or Orson Welles as an actor in his films, but not always the very major actor in the films. But we also think of John Wayne films or Ingrid Bergman films or Marilyn Monroe films and all of that. And sometimes the actor transcends the director in the sense that we can think of a John Wayne film independent of the director. We can think of John Wayne films even if a variety of directors directed John Wayne in these films. Now, I might have to think that none of these films are very good, and as a consequence, maybe this can be used as a defense of the, as a defense of the auteur theory, that when films are constructed around actors rather than expressing the visions of directors, they never become good films. But that's hard to, and you can say that about John Wayne, maybe you can say that about Marilyn Monroe, but that's hard to maintain when you, say, take up Ingrid Bergman, or you take up Clark Gable, or you take up Richard Burton, or you take up Elizabeth Taylor. There are actors and actresses that are important that way. And then, of course, there are genre films, some of them around the cult of individual action figures, Schwarzenegger and people like that. And then there are other kinds of genre films, these are my fifth and sixth points, which are films that reflect a certain type of fictional narrative, Bollywood comedies, Hollywood westerns, and all of that. And we can organize films in that way too. Now, the auteur theory's claim is, the most important claim is, that the organization of thinking about film around the directors is superior to all these other ways. Now, yes, they might be right, but it could still be the case that at a different level, these other ways of organizing films is also important and provide some insight. In fact, we could have sort of a tentative, mild endorsement of the auteur theory, where we accept that it captures a very large part of what making good films is about and how we should go about making good films, and in particular, how we should go about judging how good films are. But it is not the whole story. There are other parts of the story about actors and about genres and then themes and stuff like that. And that there can be some rational disagreement about which of these factors, how important these factors are compared to the importance of the director. That is an endorsement of the auteur theory, though it's somewhat milder. And sometimes in some of his writings, Sarris seemed to have, if not this milder version of his endorsement of the auteur theory, something not that much stronger than this. I have already pointed out earlier about the historical role of the auteur theory, and I'm not going to say any more things about it now in order to keep this discussion somewhat short. So let's finally turn to what it has contributed to film theory, criticism, film theory, and the philosophy of film, and with that, we will end the lecture. Well, what I've said so far about reorganizing discourse about film around directors, it's clear what it has contributed to film criticism, and can this be used to make better films? Well, in the French New Wave and those who supported it, this, for example, tells the director to follow personal vision over and over again and try to be very clear about what that vision is, try to make films integrated, try to make sure that every feature of that film happens to fit what the director's intent are. Go back to the Mies van der Rohe idea in architecture of God being in the details. Try to do that very systematically. So in some sense, there is some contribution that the auteur theory does make to film theory, but I do not think this is major. Lots of others would also have agreed with this as not a particularly original contribution to film theory. But the third question, when we turn to the philosophy of film, it really raises a very, very interesting question, which we will come back to later on in this course, and on which a lot has been written. What exactly is film authorship? How does it compare to authorship of other kinds of fiction, for example, novels, poetry, and things of that sort? And what's special about it? And the extent to which there is a tension, or what is the role played by the author of the script compared to the author of the film. So these are presumably two different authors. And so the question comes up, this is Bazin's question. So we may have an auteur for a film, But the auteur is the auteur of what? What exactly is authorship in this context? All right, let me stop here. Okay. Thank you.